The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, The Metamorphosis. You feel it too. Something is about to happen. It's not a single event, but rather the culmination of an anthropological process. The ancient civilizations you now know about were very advanced. The scientists of those days knew about stars, planets, and even the mechanics of interplanetary travel. They knew about the union of the polarity, where two phases of matter came together to form this earth from which we gaze into the universe. Somehow, most of them were destroyed. Those on Noah's higher planet were also nearly completely destroyed. Their system of family, with a father, mother, and naturally born children, was corrupted away by the teachings of the Nephilim. Fallen angels cast to earth, aligned with the dark side, dissuade mankind from the celestial realm of their destiny, were seduced by the beauty of mortal women. They fathered abominations with humans and animals. Their crossbred human offspring were giants endowed with immense strength and intelligence. They had every advantage over mortal mankind, yet they had no souls. They did not have the inheritance or the potential for compassion and growth with which men were endowed. They also had no enmity between their wills and that of the master adversary. His plan became their plan. Ultimately, the strategy of God was victorious. Mankind genetically starved the giants through forbidding their women by covenant the opportunity to breed with the angels or with giants. They also devised methods of warfare with sophisticated engines that allowed men to stand on equal footing with the giants in battle. Add to that fact that giants did not live long. The gravity of Earth is too much for the physiology of giants. Their bones, organs, and immunological systems doomed them to early debilitating physical problems. While they were young and virile, they were practically invincible. But as they aged, they became paralyzed or immobile. A proud and warlike race, they committed suicide rather than suffer the humiliation of being cared for. Before the Flood, the Nephilim and their many tribes of giants were successful in corrupting nearly the entire race of man. It was their mission. Simply killing everyone while they were still innocent would only fulfill the Creator's plan. The Dark Ones' victims must be captured in such a way that their free will was defeated. They had no choice but to succumb to the temptations, sparkle, glamour, and carnal pleasures of the mortal world. The plan was to taint their inheritance. If the Nephilim, their dark leader, and their offspring couldn't have a mortal experience worthy of inheriting exaltation, then the Creator's children would not have it either. It was a crime of galactic proportions. It was merciless and cold. Many mortal kings, under the advice of these combinations, designed to promise unlimited earthly power, took the brides of their enemies. This breeding was an exact copy of the efforts to rob every womb of its rightful heir. One can only imagine the fear that prevented their husbands from exacting instant revenge against their captors. Under the inspiration of many prophets and through revelation, mankind survived these crimes against humanity. They suffered, yes. The suffering was necessary in order to seal the doom upon the perpetrators. Those days were hastened, lest the entire earth suffer the same global corruption and loss of salvation that occurred before the Flood. Since the first stylus was laid to gold or clay, there has been a latent prophecy of a latter day. In this day, there would be land set aside for freedom. In this new Jerusalem, men would be able to worship God according to their own dictates. Such a land would exist. The Freemasons were keepers of the flying scrolls, containing the patterns of liberty that would have to exist in order for the final stages of the procession to occur. It was so well known in those days that when the land called America declared its independence, the British soldiers conscripted to defeat this rebellion could not fight against the prophecy. The nation set aside for the purpose of fulfilling this prophecy was being born, and nothing short of a miracle could make sure it lived. Hundreds of thousands of people sold everything they had to board a small wooden ship and risk their lives to sail to the New World for this exact purpose. If they had nothing to sell, they sold the labor of their lives and the lives of their future children to reach this land. Was it easy? No. Did they always succeed or reach their goals? Certainly not. The wealthy and powerful did their best to establish their prejudices and their methods of enslavement here as well. Those crimes were committed again and again. For nearly 300 years, this nation struggled. It still struggles. But something very strange is happening now. There is, and always has been, a line between good and evil. Since the passing of the days when cheating tithe payers dropped dead at the base of the coffers, mankind has been doing the absolute minimum to please God. For 6 millennia, we have read of the dividing of the tribes of mankind. There were those who ate, drank, and were merry, while those that obeyed the laws of God suffered under the whip. Like occupants of a global cabana, they laughed and drank and ordered the servants of the earth around to their pleasure. Since 1830, the gathering of the saints has been occurring. What does that mean? Those who are willing to follow the will of the Father are being gathered. Lands have been set apart to receive those who were willing to live these laws. Since that time, those that seek power and wealth through secret combinations have sought to destroy these people. Many millions of innocent men, women, and children have been murdered to keep the vision of equality and exaltation from being fulfilled. In the 1940s, 6 million Jews were systematically stripped of their wealth, their dignity, and murdered in every brutal method imaginable. The plan of evil was to exterminate them from the face of the earth. This plan is eternal. Ever since they made the covenant to keep their heritage free from foreign DNA, they have been hunted by the followers of the ancient combinations set down by the Nephilim. To this day, half the civilizations of earth are determined to complete the destruction of this tribe. At the time of the writing of this book, more than 200 million children have been murdered before they ever got the chance to breathe air. More than $2.5 billion was also taken from the young mothers of these children under what is arguably the most evil and corrupt genocide ever perpetrated upon mankind. Most cleverly marketed, with key words associated with freedom and health care, this billion-dollar butchery has nearly wiped out an entire generation of young people. Many nations practice this genocide, but one would not think the nations set apart as the New Jerusalem would have participated. Yes, indeed, nearly 40 million of those babies were killed in modern times, with the full knowledge and suffering of its citizens. Add to that the doubling of technology every 9 to 10 months. Almost all of the advances are being funded either by governments seeking new and more deadly weaponry, or by health organizations seeking to unravel the human genome. These weapons, such as HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, are manipulating the weather, geophysical properties of the Earth itself, or enabling commanders to disable their enemies with psychotropic vibrations. The range of effects are from mild paranoia or sleeplessness to schizophrenia, epileptic seizures, and even death through cardiac arrest or organ failure. This can be done from any location to any location on the globe with complete anonymity. Is there still evil in the world today? Yes. So what makes us any different than our ancestors who charged across the frozen tundra with battle axes in their hands? What makes us any different than the entire civilizations that migrated with their herds, their flocks, their wives and children, with the express purpose of annihilating their enemies from the face of the earth? How have we changed? Well, the gathering is nearly complete. At the time of the writing of this book, the grand division has begun as well. That line that separates good and evil was once manageable. One could live and play on the evil side all week, and then jump back over to the good side on the Sabbath, sing some songs, pay some indulgences, and all was right with the world. Those days are past. The line has gotten wider. If one is living on the evil side, there is not enough time to run back to the side of the righteous in a single week. We will have to make a choice. This is the core of this chapter. This is the metamorphosis of mankind. This division will separate the children of God just prior to the separation of the earths into their two parts. One is vibrating at a higher frequency, or glory. The other is vibrating at a lower frequency, or glory. For nearly 7 centuries, they have been in harmony as a physical earth. We live here. We die here. We have our dreams and base all of our interpretations of the universe using ideas we have formulated while living here. As far as we know, no humans have traveled to other worlds and become educated under the tutelage of off-worlders. The off-worlders have always come here and taught those who have been chosen since the foundations of the earth. So how is this done? What is the metamorphosis? How is mankind changing? Into what? A higher, more noble being? Yes, and it is happening right before our eyes. Everyone can feel it. Some will deny it because of the misery they have already suffered, but there are those who know what we know. There is a purpose and a good to life. In fact, there is a good that can be expressed or fulfilled in many ways. What are these ways? Well, there are 5. All life can be placed into one of these modes of existence. I call them the 5 worlds of existence. Once these are explained, the best description of the metamorphosis of mankind will be added. Don't skip to the end. This is perhaps the most important message you will ever read. World number 1. In philosophy, we often theorize about the good of a certain creed or methodology. In other words, when one is a model citizen of this philosophy, what will be their behavior? What will be their goal or greatest desire or their dream if they are seeking the reward of their lifestyle? This is what we mean by the good of a philosophy. In world number one, the good is the satisfaction from physical work. It might seem as though the crown of mankind's genius is the elimination of physical work from mortal life. Nothing could be further from the truth. There is a gift of pure happiness that comes from physical work. Physical labor is among the most satisfying activities for mankind. Humans, deprived of the opportunity to perform labor, are among the most miserable creatures to behold. Their misery is so overpowering they will do anything, including ingest hallucinogenic drugs, alcohol, or even commit suicide to wash away their emotional pain. Every time I go to the beach, I take a shovel and a bucket. I like to go when the tide is fairly low. Left behind the retreating cool and soothing waves is a treasure of wet sand. This is the perfect material for building sandcastles. Using the shovel, a strong back, and any kind of design one can imagine, in a few hours, the most amazing and unique sandcastles can be constructed. An easy construction would never do. The work is hard. All of the struggles of life are washed away during the process. The sweat and the sun, the weight of the sand, and the design are all part of the good. If one were to involve children as part of the process, one could witness the therapy of work shaping and growing a child as well. For you see, it is not a castle one is building at all. It is a human being. Even if participating in a contest with others to see who can build the best castle or sand sculpture, it is not the finished product that is the goal. The goal, the good of the activity, is the work of building the sandcastle. The work itself provides the satisfaction that one is doing something. When on the job, most people are very disappointed when the work of their labor must be redone because of the mistake of another. But this is because they do not understand the principle of work. Hand-cutting stone, chopping wood, lifting weights, running a marathon, cleaning house, or tending a garden are all immensely satisfying. There is actually a high that can be obtained from this physical work. Hundreds of millions of humans know the pure joy that comes from work. In this world, there is very little conscious thinking performed. In fact, there is an almost dream state that is reached through the process of working hard. Endorphins are released in copious amounts. Serotonin is also produced in large amounts. These two hormones are unbelievably powerful in the human body. It seems unfair, but there is a process of uptake in the normal physiology of the human body. These hormones make us feel great. They actually can help the body heal itself, or, more properly said, prevent it from harming itself. The high realized by the runner or the weightlifter is from these compounds. Joy and happiness are the treasures of life, and are largely derived from one's ability to produce and retain these hormones at generous levels. Possibly the largest profits in medical history are from patients who want to prevent their bodies from uptaking serotonin. Tens of millions of people take serotonin uptake inhibitors to prevent the depression that occurs when one's levels drop too low. All that may be needed is a pattern of physical work to resupply the body with the hormones needed to keep the brain from feeling depressed. HDL is the good cholesterol. LDL is the bad cholesterol. The lowering of the total cholesterol number is reported by many health professionals to be a good goal. However, the brain is made almost entirely of cholesterol. It is a tremendously complex and convertible molecule. The only safe way to lower the LDL and to raise the HDL is physical exercise. Lifting weights, running, riding a bicycle, or digging a garden by hand can replace a cabinet full of drugs. The good of work is very good. The goal is not finishing, although there is great satisfaction in seeing the results of the work as a thinner waistline, a lush garden, or the most beautiful sandcastle ever created. World number two. World number two is the world of learning. The good of this world is the learning of new things, solving problems, or the act of discovery itself. It is said that an intelligent brain trying to solve a complex problem radiates as much energy as a 75-watt light bulb. This consumes as many calories in an hour as running or walking a mile. Besides the dietary benefits of an active brain, there is nothing in the universe that creates the kind of joy provided by discovery. The contributions of every age have been recorded in every conceivable media, whether in stone, metal, paint, chalk, or paper. The ancients have tried their best to preserve their knowledge. It is through this ability primarily that man transcends the animal. Each human being starts life as an infant and spends an entire lifetime learning new skills, new concepts, and reaching far into the unknown for answers to every question. The achievements of past generations are accumulated and passed along to the next. All knowledge is not innate. That is to say, one cannot figure out everything without a source for the knowledge other than one's own imagination. There are outside sources from which we can draw information if we are ready to receive it. When the end of all known knowledge is reached by a person, that person can reach out beyond himself to a maelstrom of information in countless forms. If he is able, he can withdraw from that experience with pure knowledge in his possession. We would like to say something about sources of knowledge here. There are many sources of knowledge. Some are evil. Some are good. There are evil men who seek knowledge, just as there are good men who seek knowledge. The utmost care should be taken to qualify the source of knowledge before consuming that knowledge. You may make a conscious choice when you learn. The mind is the most powerful of human capacities and is driven by the spirit of a person. The spirit of a person can either act or be acted upon by the knowledge pouring into the mind. If we act, then we can accept, reject, or qualify the knowledge. In other words, just because you listen to a song full of foul language, power chords, and screaming, it does not mean you choose to use such language or seek out the nearest body-piercing studio. Just because you watch an R-rated movie full of death, explosions, and gore, it does not mean you will choose to use violence in your own life. Unfortunately, even though we learn divine principles full of the mysteries of heaven, it does not mean we will choose to live righteously or seek the welfare of another human being. The Nephilim had every blessing of heaven. They had lived their lives and received their immortality, yet they succumbed to the temptations of carnality and chose eternal damnation rather than continue to live as angels. This is what makes the world of learning so incredibly powerful. There is no boundary to human existence. We have the birthright to learn everything. We have what every race in the universe is seeking. We have the ability to transcend and overcome mortal life as a complete soul. There is no possible way this can be accomplished in ignorance. We must have all knowledge. Whether in mortal life or in a later phase of our growth, we will have the opportunity to learn continually laid before us. This is one of the most primal urges of men with souls. There is nothing more glorious and more exuberating than the discovery of new knowledge. It is why we develop language. It is why, with that language, we develop new symbols and formulas and diagrams to compress knowledge into terms that can be manipulated into more and more complete picture of the universe, time, and perhaps even God. But know this. Because it is this great treasure of joy and life, it is also the goal of evil to prevent mankind from learning anything other than those things that give it power. Hundreds of millions of books have been melted down, burned, buried, or erased by evil men trying to gain or regain power over the people. The early Catholic Church systematically confiscated all knowledge in the known world. They killed those who knew it. They killed those who possessed it. They killed those who professed to know anything other than that which the Church allowed men to know, or that which they themselves had fabricated and distributed. They fought or financed wars to keep ages of mankind so ignorant they could not read or think about anything except the dark and choiceless world of fear and homage that kept them in power and wealth. It is only through the proliferation of knowledge that men remain free. The Gutenberg press was the greatest invention of the first 6,400 years of modern time. This one invention allowed pure knowledge to be learned by the people. Millions of people learned to read using only the manuscripts translated and printed on presses throughout Europe and carried to all parts of the world. This greatly diluted the Catholic Church's stranglehold on the minds of the world. Once the people had access to knowledge, neither tyrants nor suppressors could hold them slaves any longer. They began once again to see their potential. Within 50 years, the exploration of the universe had resumed. Within 200 years, the stage was set for the establishment of the New Jerusalem and the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. The next great invention was the Internet. This is the Gutenberg press of the 21st century. It only took 10 years for the world to leap past institutional learning. Once the Internet became accessible to everyone in about the year 1996, by the year 2010, there will be no need for a college diploma to secure one's future earning ability. The brightest minds of all ages now have full and unfettered access to all the raw and unfiltered knowledge in the world in every language. As fast as those minds consume existing knowledge, they are transmitting new knowledge, which in turn is being consumed by other minds. The kings of curricula in the universities of the world have lost their monopoly on knowledge. People all over the globe are gaining knowledge so quickly that they will soon outstrip the knowledge of the doctors of tradition. New math, new science, and new music is being forged out of truth so quickly they cannot maintain control of it. The first cure for a virus will soon be found. All major diseases, such as diabetes, arthritis, cystic fibrosis, and many forms of cancer, will be cured. Human lives will be extended through healthy living and medical miracles to ages far beyond that of a tree. The quality of life will be better than any life ever lived on the face of the earth in any age. All people will be able to reach their fullest potential in mortal life because they will have access to knowledge, the energy and food to pursue it, and the freedom to enjoy the fruits thereof. That sounds like a fantasy world to us now, but it is true. This is the core of the metamorphosis. Without this advanced knowledge of mankind's relationship with all lives, living and long since dead, in the universe, this will not be possible. But truth is truth. This is the destiny of mankind, and all the evil in the universe will be organized against it, ever coming to pass. The time will soon come when the grand division will result in two great armies arranged against each other. There will be those who know the value and the good of learning, and there will be those whose sole design is to destroy any freedom of choice or any ability to learn truth from off the face of the earth. They will seek to discredit those who have learned on their own. Only those who have successfully paid their way through the halls of tradition will be allowed to call themselves learned. The knowledge kings have decreed that they must maintain control over knowledge, lest they lose their place in line for the awards of men. As long as the internet provides free access to the libraries of the world to those who thirst for knowledge, the foundations for the metamorphosis can be built. If the foundations can be built, then the leaderless revolution of the masses breeding new knowledge amongst their interactive minds will overwhelm any king's ability to stop them. As a race, through this revolution of knowledge, we may realize the solution for transcending the animal inside of us. We may at last see our true selves as spiritual beings merely having a mortal experience. World number three. World number three is that of mischief and evil. It might be a little confusing how there could be a good to this world. There is a level of satisfaction that comes from this kind of activity. In a survey of violent patients of a criminal psychologist, it was revealed that there is extreme gratification experienced by persons hurting other persons. In at least 6 case studies, the male perpetrators received an erection immediately after punching another person. Similar studies indicated that serial killers murder not through a feeling of anger or an insatiable desire for revenge, but rather for the dose of adrenaline or feeling of euphoria that overcame them during the act of murder. The rush of satisfaction was not unlike that of an addictive drug being pumped directly into one's veins. It gets worse. Because of the aggressive nature of people in this world of existence, they may quickly rise to positions of power and influence. The apathetic nature of the peaceful people on the earth supports evil leaders into office as surely as if they had donated their life savings and carried banners for their campaigns. History is full of these leaders who somehow construct the level of indoctrination. Indoctrination is intrinsically different than instruction. Instruction involves the free agency of the student to accept or reject the teaching. Learning from instruction is a process of thinking and critical examination and testing. The student invariably comes away with his own flavor or interpretation of the lessons, able to build upon that knowledge for his own ends. If every chemistry student learned the science like a clone of his or her instructor, we would still be trying to turn lead into gold while wearing long black robes and pointed hats with stars on them. No, each student stands upon the educational shoulders of the knowledge he has assimilated and reaches ever higher into new frontiers. However, with indoctrination, the lessons are not offered as a matter of choice or left open to interpretation. Instead, the subject, we cannot think about them as a student at all, is forced to recite the doctrine over and over until he can repeat it with exactness and confidence. There is no room for individual thought or action. The mass of subjects become one in purpose and process. No matter which member of the mass to whom you pose a question, you will receive precisely the same answer. In order for indoctrination to be successful, all individuals must be brought into submission to the doctrine, or they must be destroyed. The ancient philosophy is, any nail sticking up is hammered down. This pertains to the ancient Japanese social tradition, which does not allow for stupidity or brilliance. Instead, everyone will wear the same uniform, sing the same way, walk in a single file, cut their hair the same way, and will not display any behavior that causes an individual to be distinguished from the mass. In order for indoctrination to be successful, it must begin at very early stages of development, or become the terms of employment or survival for the individual. The administrators of the indoctrination never practice their own doctrine. The leaders are free thinkers. The leaders are the individuals with their finger on the button. The leaders are the ones who craft the message, outline the plans, and of course wield the power of the mass. Success comes only when the doctrine has been ingrained into each individual in the mass, to the point that there is no wavering, no questioning. And I suppose each of you have heard these words at some time in your lives. You are not being paid to think. You are being paid to do what you're told. When indoctrination is successful, the leader can step to the pulpit and add the force of his minions to each word he professes. This, as my little green friend would say, leads to the dark side. Only evil can come from such a system, and evil comes only from one source. That source has only one mission. That mission is to corrupt and eternally occupy all human life in the universe. We have many ancient examples of indoctrination that was successful in sudden population control. That is to say, huge numbers of people were killed or brought into slavery. We will leave those to another book. There are two modern examples of indoctrination of the most heinous and evil kind that we will use for this story. The first is the most horrible and evil example of indoctrination since Satan drew a third of the host of heaven with him to hell. In the 20th and the beginning of the 21st centuries, the art of war changed. Superpowers developed weaponry that was so powerful that by 1945, traditional warfare was rendered obsolete. The instantaneous death of hundreds of thousands of Japanese citizens with two flashes of uncontrolled atomic energy changed everything. Since the earth cooled, men have lined up on either side of the battlefield and charged across the frozen tundra at one another with their battle axes, staves, swords, and hammers, and hacked at each other all day until victory was achieved. Now, can you imagine yourself holding a sword in open battle and defending yourself against horsemen, archers, fireballs, and hordes of berserk fighters trying to kill you? Of course you can. But can you imagine being ordered to charge against another people with the intent of killing every last man, woman, and child, down to the last infant, in order to take their lands, their homes, and all their resources for your leaders? Perhaps not. Perhaps you have not been indoctrinated to that point of barbarism. But in 1945, traditional warfare became impractical. No longer could a million soldiers devise any strategy that would allow them to march against an atomic bomb. Traditional armies became obsolete. New atomic technology proliferated. Soon, both sides had a race to see who could build the most atomic bombs. It became apparent that a new set of battle rules needed to be developed. The art of war became the art of diplomacy with weapons. It was called mutually assured destruction, or MAD for short. Both sides knew that if one pushed the button to deploy their weapons against the other, that the attacked would do the same. With no way to defend against these weapons, each side was assured that they would be annihilated without reserve. There may indeed be a victory, but the winner would have lost so many people and so much infrastructure that the leaders would have to go back to raising their own food and washing their own clothes in a wash tub by hand. The race proved too expensive. The people supplying the revenue for the race through confiscation of their wages could not provide the economic machine it took to stay in the race. Shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Empire, the republics decided nuclear weapons could not be used again. Too many innocent people might be killed in the process. Armies had to find a more efficient and less collateral process to fight one another. Once again, armies were built in ranks and supplied with traditional equipment. Swords and rifles and tanks and planes and ships were once again lined up on either side of the borders. And once again, dictators, those who dictate the doctrine to the indoctrinated, lashed their voices against the weak and innocent and sought to take the spoils of war. By the early 1990s, blind rage and greed empowered another tyrant to invade an innocent country and steal their wealth. This time, the United States was in a position to help the conquered nation. Within a few weeks of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, millions of tons of armament and weaponry began positioning for the mother of all battles. Within months, war had taken on a new face. Technology allowed the construction of new weapons that could be deployed with such accuracy that only the target was destroyed. That same technology allowed the public viewing of live warfare in the safety of one's home or office with popcorn and soda. Unlike the aristocrats who scurried down to the battlefield with a picnic lunch of fried chicken, freshly baked biscuits and celery to watch the first skirmish of the war of northern aggression, the television witness could not smell the stench of death or hear the screams of pain as the hell of war ripped human spirits from their bodies. The viewer could simply turn it off or switch to sports or walk to the safety of their own kitchen for another glass of milk and a warm cookie. The presence of destruction was pure entertainment. When a missile went down the ventilation shaft of a single building to destroy the enemy from 25,000 feet, it was not unlike the perfect threading of a football through the chaos of defense gracefully into the hands of the offensive receiver's hands, for a touchdown. The precise delivery of bombs were touchdowns. When a single bridge was destroyed with a single bomb, without a single human casualty, the worldwide ooh or ah could almost be heard, as if the finger of God had reached down and smashed an insect without harming anything around it. We even had the option of instant replay. There was another level of success in the new methods of warfare. One cannot build an army without money. Bombs, uniforms, food, and equipment cost money. The art of war added to the color, manipulating the money so that enemies could not build armies. Much like cutting off the supply line and waiting for the soldiers to starve, great and marvelous technologies were crafted to keep money out of the hands of dictators. They were called sanctions. Revenue was stopped. Bank accounts were seized. The currency of the dictator was nullified. With the combination of these tactics, it was thought that warfare had been made obsolete. One cannot underestimate the power of evil. Indoctrination never ends. A new weapon was built that would be successful against any defense. Like a pachinko ball, this weapon would bounce from pin to pin, innocuously through the obstacles until it reached its target and delivered its explosives. Masses of ghost-like soldiers could be controlled through an almost unbreakable bond that keeps them applied to the task. The new doctrine would link the success of their suicide to their eternal reward in heaven. Each soldier must be like the other, precise and willing to complete any mission, demanding the sacrifice of his or her life without hesitation. This new indoctrination would have to be thorough and begin at a very early age. The new dictator has learned the lessons of evil from the master of evil himself. First, every single person in the society must live in absolute squalor. If there is fresh drinking water, it must be drawn by hand and hauled by hand every day. Storing water would be forbidden. There would be no individual wealth allowed. Only the state would acquire wealth. There would be no travel allowed. There would be no access to news, weather, entertainment, or other activities that might weaken the grip of poverty, even for a moment. All of these things would be labeled as evil and temptations of their enemy. Next, the dictator must paint a picture of heaven that is so beautiful and so glorious that without exception every human being desires it more than food or love or even life itself. Each child would be taught from birth that he or she had a single goal in life. That goal is to reach heaven through the suicidal extermination of the enemies of the state. To make sure that the indoctrination is complete, the dictator himself must be willing to murder without compunction. Family members, neighbors, and especially ethnic groups must be summarily taken to the public square and slaughtered or tortured so the masses can plainly see the difference between heaven and their present state of affairs. Neither executed people nor their families would ever see a single chilled grape in heaven. A few thousand executions a year is all that is normally required to keep a complete society in line. Now, what does this have to do with the third world of existence? This is the good of the third world of existence, the world of mischief and evil. To be the dictator of such a land is the ultimate power on earth promised by the evil one. Each and every member of this world of existence is dedicated to death, pain, pleasure, and all replacements of inspiration, such as thrills, adrenaline rushes, drug-induced stupors, and even raves of sex. And when the armies of the peacemakers march forward to vanquish such a land, they will be surprised. When the armies arrive to fight, all they will find are innocent people playing ball or singing songs or having a party. There will be no soldiers. There will be no weapons. There will be no tanks or planes or ships to target. There will only be masses of people peacefully praying to their God. The dictator knows that national television will be showing the world how harmless and peaceful they are, and how their lives should be spared, and how horrible the soldiers are treating them by desecrating their holy ground with their unwanted presence. And if the soldiers do not leave, then the dictator unfolds his war. This is where the indoctrination yields its treasure. In the darkness of their covenant with death and hell, the child soldiers slide their bodies inside their weapons. In willing innocence, they sift through the defenses of their dictator's enemy like cold air under the windward door, and they detonate their weapon. In a flash of smoke and metal, they are translated to their heaven while their enemy is murdered. Like slashing at ghosts who suddenly materialize and slay a few of their comrades, the soldiers will attack the wind. Their search for their attacker is pointless. He is evil itself. He is in another dimension, fortifying the dictator's power. He is creating enemies of the soldiers with each explosion. How does he do that? How do enemies breed when the soldiers of the dictator die with each attack? Ah, this is the master stroke of genius in this most evil style of warfare. Even more efficient than the indoctrination of the human missiles is the utilization of greed. The dictator has ultimate power. He has received his ultimate reward for his covenant with the evil one. But the evil one does not want one side to win or lose. No, no. His goal is to capture both sides in the conflict. He already owns the dictator. Now he wants to own the people who are attacking the dictator as well. He does this through greed. Since the society of the superpower is free and open, allowing each individual to seek after his greatest potential according to his own dictates, it makes the perfect breeding ground for greed. A free and open society will always have at least two political factions, but unlike traditional enemies, they debate and posture and convince their constituencies of their benefits instead of marshaling armies. But power is power. Temptation is temptation, and greed is greed. The ruling party gets the blame for all things that go wrong. Credit for positive accomplishment is only given long after the historians get through with the story. The party that is out of power seeks to defeat the ruling party because the ruling party has access to the money, lots of money, all the money in the world. The ruling party wields the faith and credit of the nation. Now we have the stage set for the evil one to do his will. As the dictator kills soldiers with his ghost bombers, the political party that is out of power will blame the ruling party for its incompetence and poor leadership. If it appears like this political party of the superpower is working with the dictator, you have become a very astute observer. It is worse than that. The greed and lust of this political party can be so great that the leaders of this party covenant with the evil one to gain this power. Now you can see how the good in the third world of existence has destroyed so many civilizations before us. Both the dictator the enemy of all that is good and decent, and the superpower's political leaders are sworn to follow the same dark lord to the death in order to be granted ultimate power and glory on this earth. Everyone hates, everyone lusts, everyone dies. The perfect plan has unfolded without flaw, time after time, until the last vestige of that civilization evaporated from the planet, and the survivors are reduced to hunting insects and gathering berries all day, every day, while they pray unceasingly to their God for deliverance.